Well, welcome to Stars, Cells, and God. I'm Hugh Ross, the founder and president of Reasons to Believe, and I'm joined today by Fuzz Rana, our staff biochemist and a leader of our scholar community. Welcome, Fuzz.
Thank you, Hugh.
And all of you, we do post these shows at our YouTube channel, and you can subscribe for free to our YouTube channel, and that way you'll be notified of all the different videos that we're bringing out. And there's literally thousands of our videos that are posted there on the Reasons to Believe YouTube channel. Also, go to Reasons. It's actually Reasons. Pardon me. What is it, Fuzz?
It's the YouTube channel?
No, I'm talking about the portal to the...
RTB underscore official.
RTB underscore official. That's your RTB underscore official is your portal to all the social media venues that Reasons to Believe sponsors. And that will also get you to the Facebook page because we're now actually showing this recordings of the show on the Facebook channel as well as the YouTube channel. But go to the YouTube channel because that's where you'll see all the rest of the Reasons to Believe video postings. Now, Fuzz, you got an amazing discovery to talk about. 45-page article in Cell, but I found it was incredibly easy to read, beautiful diagrams. Yeah. So what's this breakthrough that just got published?
Yeah. Well, it's an exciting piece of work involving computer simulations of a whole cell. And so this is one of the most sophisticated computer simulations done to date with respect to whole cells. But to kind of maybe set the stage so people can really appreciate the significance of the work, I actually have a question for you.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Yeah. And there's a method to this madness. But when you were at Caltech, did you have a chance to interact with Richard Feynman?
Well, I did, not only at Caltech. I enjoyed hiking in the San Gabriel Mountains above Pasadena. He did too. So I'd always see him there on the trail with his dog. And I got to talk to him both at Caltech and outside of Caltech. And I knew Dom Page well. And Dom Page's supervisor was Richard Feynman. So I got tons of stories I can tell you about Richard Feynman.
Yeah. Well, and he probably was one of the most significant scientists in the 20th century. And he won the Nobel Prize quantum chromodynamics or something like that?
Quantum dynamics.
Yeah.
So he's a Nobel Prize winner. Probably most famous for the courses he taught, where he would get undergraduate students, freshman undergraduate students, and teach them a graduate level course in physics. Overwhelmed the students, but the books that he produced were really breakthrough books in physics instruction.
Yeah, well, there's a famous quote. The reason I bring up Richard Feynman, there's a famous quote that Feynman is responsible for that actually really sets the stage for what I want to talk about. And the quote is, "What I cannot create, I do not understand." And maybe you're familiar with that quote.
Oh, yeah.
And kind of the sentiment there is that, most scientists, when they study phenomena, think about it analytically, where they take it apart and they try to understand mechanistically what's happening. But Feynman's point is that if we truly understand that phenomena, we should be able to reproduce it. We should be able to recreate it. And that mindset actually is influencing an approach that a number of life scientists are taking to understand some of the basic questions about biochemistry and about what life is itself and what are key life processes. And the approach is called build to understand, mm-hmm. right? And so the idea is that, biochemical systems and the cell itself is so complex that we think we understand what's going on, but if we really want to make sure we understand, then we need to try to build a cell.
And build to better understand, not completely understand, right?
Yes, right. But the idea is that as you try to build it and you realize that you're unable to achieve certain things, it kind of directs your attention towards what you need to learn,
right?
To be able to fill in the missing pieces. And this is really the spirit that undergirds a discipline called synthetic biology. And this is, in my estimation, one of the most exciting and most important areas of the life science today.
Now, Fuzz, you've written an entire book on this subject.
Yes. Well, a book dealing with a facet of synthetic biology called Creating Life in the Lab.
And right.
I'm actually working on another book that is also dealing with synthetic biology more broadly. And that book, working title is Should We Play God? But, you know, the idea behind synthetic biology in a nutshell is researchers want to use their understanding of biological systems to create novel, non-natural life forms. And people are working on plants, they're working on animals. Most of the attention is on bacteria and single-celled organisms like yeast, with the idea is that if we can create these artificial, non-natural life forms, we can design them in such a way that they can be used for technology purposes, that these organisms can function like bioreactors, where we feed them relatively inexpensive food stuff, and they're able to convert that food stuff into highly valuable products.
Well, one example is petroleum, or they're trying to develop a bacterium that will take cheap products that we feed them and produce petroleum for us.
That's a beautiful example. Yeah, so, and it's, you know, biofuels, bioplastics, and other industrial products that otherwise would be very harsh on the environment to produce, drugs, vaccines, you know, the list goes on and on. And so this is really representing the what some people call the fourth revolution in technology, that we're using biology as a form of technology. And, you know, one of the big areas in synthetic biology is the quest to create synthetic cells. One approach is the bottom-up approach, where people take simple molecules and they try to combine them and assemble them into these chemical super systems that begin to assume the properties of life. And sometimes these are referred to as protocells. The other approach is called a top-down approach, which is to start with a relatively simple microorganism and try to strip away all of its non-essential biochemistry. So you wind up with a cell that has the basic core requirements for life. And then that can serve as a chassis to which you can then add very specific metabolic capabilities to create, again, a wide range of synthetic cells. This approach towards a minimal cell also has the added advantage of helping us to understand, again, biochemistry and life at a much more fundamental level. So there's really a basic science motivation as well as a technology motivation.
So simplify to try to get some more understanding.
Yes. Now, the first scientist to suggest this approach of creating a minimal cell was actually Harold Morowitz, and this is a picture of Harold Morowitz. He died a number of years ago now, but a very famous origin of life researcher. And his idea was that if we studied a group of bacteria known as the mycoplasmas, that we could use them as a model system to help us understand.
Now, what are these mycoplasmas?
Well, they are a group of bacteria that are parasites. They're infectious agents, and they are among the simplest life forms that we know, in part because they don't have a cell wall. They just have a cell membrane. So right away, that simplifies their biochemistry quite a bit.
And the fact that they're parasites means there's a lot of stuff that they can get by without.
Yes, exactly. So one organism we're going to talk about in a minute is Mycoplasma genitalium. And because it's a surface parasite infecting humans, it's a organism responsible for sexually transmitted diseases based on the name Mycoplasma right. genitalium. It is able to live without a lot of biochemistry because, again, it's a parasite. And so it can jettison genes from its genome that are, in a sense, quote unquote, non-essential, because it can rely on the host cell's biochemistry to survive. Well, in the mid-1990s, Craig Venter and his collaborators had this idea that Mycoplasma genitalium would be an ideal organism to try out a new sequencing technique they developed called shotgun sequencing. And so they sequenced the genome of Mycoplasma genitalium. It has maybe about 500 genes in its genome. It's one of the smallest genomes that we are aware of. And so this was the second organism to have its genome sequenced. But Venter and his collaborators realized that this is an ideal organism to try to discover what would be the minimal genome. And so they developed a number of techniques where they could disable genes both systematically and randomly. in the mycoplasm genome. And in the process of doing that, if the organism would grow, you eliminate a gene and it would grow, you would dub it non-essential. It's a not very complex concept. And they whittled the genome down to about 380 genes that they identified as the minimum genome. Now, and here's a picture, by the way, of mycoplasm genitalium, just in case people want to see it. This is an artistic rendition. It's not an actual scientific image. But what they realize is that if indeed they've discovered a minimum genome, the way to confirm that would be to chemically synthesize that genome and transfect another microorganism with the hope that the synthetic genome would supplant the native genome. And if that organism could essentially be rebooted as a minimal cell and live, then they indeed discovered the minimum genome.
Right.
So that it's a simple concept. Well, it took them probably close to 10 years to actually develop the methodology to synthesize an entire genome. That in and of itself was a scientific tour de force to accomplish that, because up to that point, the maximum size that you could synthesize for DNA was maybe 200 base pairs, and you're looking at having to synthesize a genome that's 500,000 base pairs.
Right.
So it took quite a bit of effort to actually develop that synthetic method. They also, at the same time, developed methods in which they could actually transfer one entire genome from one organism into the other, where the transferred genome would actually supplant, again, the native genome. And so they pulled this all together in 2010, creating an organism that they called JCVI-SYN-1.0. And they nicknamed this organism Cynthia, where they actually synthesized the genome for Mycoplasma mycoides and then transfected a Mycoplasma capricolum. And in a few generations, a few rounds of cell division, that the capricolum cells disappeared and they were basically the synthetic versions of Mycoplasma mycoides. They then, about 5 years later, through a trial and error approach, trimmed down that synthetic genome to 473 genes. Those cells were able to live, but they reproduced in an anomalous way. And so they realized they had to add back some additional genes mm-hmm. in order to create what's called JCVI-SYN 3.A. It actually should be 3.A in that diagram. And so this is what those particular cells look like. So this is actually a scientific image of, in a sense, a synthetic, what they dub a near minimal cell.
480 gene products?
Thereabouts, 473 or so, something like that.
Oh, so this is the 3.0, not the 3.0A.
The 3.A is about 400 gene products,
okay.
493, whereas the 3.0 is 473 products.
Right.
Now, so this is actually a larger minimal genome than what they discovered with Mycoplasma genitalium. So this is a minimum genome for Mycoplasma mycoides. And what they learned in the process is that a minimum genome is relative to the particular organism you're working with. So that's a little bit of an interesting discovery. But when they looked at the genome, they discovered a number of genes that were involved in different processes, gene expression, membrane, structure and function, metabolism, and then a significant number, probably close to, 150 genes were of unknown function. And they've since then have discovered function. But so right now, it's about 75 genes or so that we just don't know what they do. But they are essential.
You have to have. Otherwise, if you remove them, the organism dies.
Yes. Yeah. So now that you have this near minimal cell that actually can be grown in a laboratory, that's truly a synthetic cell. You can do some interesting things with it, right? You can use this as a chassis to add genes to create a wide range of microorganisms, synthetic microbes that can do all kinds of neat things from an application standpoint. But it also is a great way to study fundamental biochemical questions. And this is where the paper that I want to talk about today comes into play, because this team from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, in collaboration with people from the J. Craig Venter Institute, developed essentially a computer simulation that allowed them now to essentially monitor on a time on a time basis what happens to all of the biomolecules that are inside that cell as a function of time. So let me just make sure I get this right, because there's a long list here. But they basically can monitor essentially the genetic information processes, the process of DNA replication and transcription. They can monitor the activity and the distribution in the cell, as well as the concentration of 148 metabolites, 452 proteins, and then messenger RNAs and transfer RNAs, and then 503 ribosomes. And so what they did to start their simulation was take a cryo TEM electron micrograph of the cell, so they could position everything, or as much as they could, primarily the ribosomes. And then they would just simply, through the rates of transcription, the rates of diffusion, different metabolic fluxes, all these types of things, they could mathematically monitor the behavior of all these, you know, materials.
But the data was inputted by real-time cryo-electron
images? It's how they gave the initial position to primarily the ribosomes. How are the ribosomes distributed? Where was the DNA, the genome? So they would at least get a starting point that was a realistic, real-life starting point. And then once that was in place, it was essentially the mathematical characterization of these different processes as a function of kinetics.
But where did they get the rates?
Oh, well, a lot of that stuff is known. So we know what the rate is for gene expression and for gene expression of different, genes in the genome. We know what the rate of translation is. You can estimate diffusion rates.
And the manufacturing rates of the proteins you can measure?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
You can measure the flux of...
So those are the inputs they put into the computer
simulation. Right. So there's really good kinetic data for a lot of these things. But the problem is, one is you want to make sure that you're modeling, because this is very intensive in terms of computer time, to have all these processes going on simultaneously as a function of time. It's an enormous amount of, computer power that's needed to do this, you want to make sure that what you're actually modeling is a real cell, that's a real minimal cell. So in other words, that having that minimal cell allowed us to even build the model. Now, they discovered some interesting things that really kind of validate the model. For example, they noticed that right before DNA replication took place, there was an accumulation of proteins at the origin of replication, which is what you would expect, but it's nice that the model produces that. They noticed that when there was a steady state level of the metabolites, but just because of statistical effects, sometimes the metabolite levels would drop. And when that happened, all the different biochemical processes would slow down. And then when the stores of those metabolites were replenished, things would speed up again. So again, that's a comforting result, because it's what you would expect. They also actually measured the replication time. And for their model, the replication time was, 105 minutes, and in real life, it's 98 minutes for the generation time, or the time that the cell replicates. So the point here is that none of this is revolutionary, but what it's saying is that we now have a computer model that allows us to begin to ask fundamental biochemical questions. So this now gives a very powerful tool to do some very interesting work from a basic science standpoint and from a biotechnology standpoint. Now, there's all kinds of different ways we could go apologetically with this. One is just simply highlighting just the sheer complexity of even a minimal cell. I mean, the amount of effort it takes to, number one, create the minimal cell, and then to even begin the process of trying to model it just highlights the sheer complexity, you know, and that in and of itself, I think, is suggestive that there's got to be more than just unguided evolutionary processes.
You're going to need somebody a little bit smarter than the biochemists that work for Craig Venter.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, and this project is literally 25 years in the making. So my time at RTB, I've watched this process unfold. I've been here for 23 years, so I've literally watched these developments happen during my time at RTB. And so this is an incredible scientific accomplishment, but it just, again, highlighting the sheer complexity. But something that I think is a little bit fun is really when you talk about work like this, it brings up this question, should we play God, right? You know, and it's understandable because there's all kinds of ethical questions that arise as a consequence of this work. Now, primarily, people are more concerned, I think, in this case with biosafety issues, but nevertheless, it brings up these interesting questions. And so the project that I'm working on, Should We Play God, is an attempt to try to discuss, you know, a theology for synthetic biology. And so I'm going to be working with George Harrakson, who's a philosopher and a theologian, to kind of help flesh out this theology for synthetic biology. But if we think about the grand Christian narrative of the creation, fall, and redemption, that actually is a helpful way to think about this theologically. You know, and I'm just going to go through this really quickly. But in a nutshell, you know, we are created in God's image, and we've been given certain responsibilities to be caretakers of the creation, but we've also been granted dominion over the creation. And so from my perspective, when people ask the question, should we play God, my response is that, well, as image bearers, we have no choice but to play God, right? Because we're creators ourselves. And so trying to create life in the lab is a natural, I think, reflection of the fact that we bear God's
image. Yeah,
just
to be clear, what they're doing is not creating life from scratch. They're taking existing life and re-engineering it. But that brings up ethics questions, because you could re-engineer these cells to produce material that's very beneficial for society, but you could also use it to produce weapons.
Yeah, well, and that's where I think the idea of the fall comes into play, is that I think our work in creating these types of cells and the motivation for using them for good purposes really is part of the mandate that God has given us, again, to be image, to have dominion over the creation and to be caretakers of the creation, because we're to, you know, unleash what's within the creation, you know, for our benefit. And, you know, so we want to see humans flourish. We want to see economic growth. We want to see, you know, people live at a high quality of existence. We want to use this technology to treat diseases. This is all, you know.
If we could use it to treat diseases, or we could use it to create diseases.
That's right.
So
and this is
both ways.
This is the concern, is because of the fall, you know, are our motivations pure? You know, some people's might be, but other people's, you know, may have nefarious purposes in mind, particularly with respect to bioterrorism. But also we lack wisdom. And so we could do something with the best of intentions and unleash a disaster of biblical proportions. And so when people express this concern, should we play God, I think what they really are concerned about isn't so much the fact that we're exercising our dominion over creation, it's that they are concerned about our fallen nature and our lack of wisdom. You know, but one of the things that I think is interesting is that we also are living at a time of where redemption is possible, right? Where because of Christ, all things are made new. And so if we think about synthetic biology in light of redemption, you know, the redemption that is offered through the gospel, and I'd be curious to see your reaction to this, hopefully I'm not saying anything too heretical, is not only restoring our relationship with God, but there's other dimensions to the gospel, like our reconciliation with other people, right, is possible, as well as our reconciliation with the creation, you know, because we were given dominion over the creation. We were to be caretakers of the creation. And yet when human beings fell, you know, God pointed out that the creation is cursed because of us. And, you know, you and I don't see that as God changing the creation, but rather our relationship to the creation changed. And now that we're in a fallen state, we're not able to be appropriate caretakers. So instead of taking advantage and using the creation for our benefit, but keeping in mind the necessity of benefiting all life on the planet, we exploit the creation and we do damage to it. But, you know, it's through the gospel that that dimension of our relationship to the creation is restored.
Yeah, we're to care for all creation, which means not just our benefit, but the benefit of all the life on planet Earth. And hey, maybe we can come up with a breakthrough that's going to be a blessing to our enemies, our human enemies. That would really be the Christian message.
Right. Well, and so the point is that through the gospel, you know, if the influence of the gospel comes into play, then these types of advances in synthetic biology become much less frightening. You know, and so this is, you know, why it's so important that Christians not only understand these types of advances and not only are engaging our culture, but that we actually are encouraging young people.
I'll tell you what scared me about this paper, Fuzz, is reading it. You know, it's got 493 gene products and 94 that they know are crucial because if they take it out, the cell dies.
Yep.
But they have no idea what the function is.
Yep.
And if you have no idea what the function is, then re-engineering this thing for making petroleum or curing a disease, you could easily have unintended consequences.
Oh, yeah.
So, hey, if you don't understand the functions of these 94, do you really want to play God?
Yeah. Well, you know, and you know, this, again, is, I think, a genuine concern that I would never want to minimize it. But on the other hand, the potential power of this technology to do good is enormous. And so, you know, how do we navigate that? And the last thing we want to do, I think, as Christians is capitulate synthetic biology to the realm of non-believers. We want to be salt and light in that community. We want people that are experts, that are the world-leading experts in synthetic biology from a Christian worldview perspective to be pioneering these advances and using their influence as Christians to really help ensure that the technology is really used in a way that helps us fulfill, you know, the kingdom of God mandates.
Well, also tells me we're probably missing a lot of the design that's at this biological level. Okay, we know that if you take that gene out, it's going to kill the organism.
Yeah.
But if you really don't understand the function, that means we're overlooking a crucial divine design feature.
Yeah.
And we as Christians should be highly motivated. Let's find out what that is. If for no other reason, it's going to eliminate unintended consequences, but it's also going to have huge apologetic payoff.
Yes, I would agree. And, you know, what's interesting is that initially, when they did complete the first version of this minimal genome, there's about 149 gene products that they didn't understand. So now the numbers,
it's only 94.
and hopefully this computer model, and this is kind of a interesting diagram that kind of shows, you know, how they were essentially representing the ribosomes or the yellow balls, the cell membrane, or these green blocks, and you've got proteins in there that you can see that are.
So what's the blue stuff?
The blue and red are in green are protein, different.
Got it.
So they're, you know, representing them as spheres. They're not, you know, the actual structure. But again, these are just ways in which you can begin to envision the movement of these materials inside the cell.
Yeah, one thing I would recommend to people watching this, get this paper. It's free. You don't have to pay for it.
Yeah.
But the diagrams alone are they're in color, and I just found them very useful for understanding the incredible complexity inside the cell.
Yeah.
Maybe you know something better, but I was impressed. It's the best I've seen.
Yeah, it's a very impressive piece of work, to be certain. And people have, you know, again, tried building these kind of models. So it's not the first time anybody's built a model like this, but this is a model that, again, is the simplest system that we know can live, you know, at least in a laboratory setting.
Right.
You know, and so, you know, that's pretty impressive work. But, you know, this is a landmark achievement that is really going to set the stage for, again, a lot of developments in synthetic biology involving synthetic cells, where the vision, you know, 25 years ago is beginning to be realized.
So what do you think we can look forward to, say, in the next 5 years?
Gosh, that's really hard to predict.
Okay.
Well, you know, and I say that because it once Venter and his team achieved, you know, the synthetic version of the very Syn 1.0, Cynthia, which was 2010, it's taken them 11 years to go from that to a genuinely bona fide minimal cell. So even though they knew how to do it, it still took them 11 years. So I suspect the progress will come, but it's going to be hard earned. The idea of just adding genes to the minimum genome and expecting suddenly that minimum cell is going to do what we want is really naive. I think it's going to take a lot of effort to figure out how to add genes in such a way that you actually are producing a synthetic cell that does what you really want it to do.
Now, is it fair to say that probably the first thing we're going to see is re-engineering these cells to manufacture chemicals that are going to be a lot cheaper than we do right now?
Yep.
And it may be a while before we can actually re-engineer these things to cure human health issues?
Yeah, well, you know, people have already done work, for example, with yeast, where they've been able to do metabolic engineering and produce yeast, for example, that can make, anti-cancer compounds that would be otherwise inaccessible, practically inaccessible by extracting them from nature. And so, you know, that kind of work is possible, but you're dealing with yeast, which are not minimal organisms. Here you're dealing with a minimal cell that is a very, very finicky cell that has to be grown under highly stringent, just right conditions in the lab, you know, to get it to work. So I suspect it's going to be much harder to do something comparable in these minimal cells. But this is where this model, you know, becomes very powerful, is because you can run simulations and right away get an idea, is it going to work or not, versus going through elaborate laboratory work to create the synthetic genome and then try it out and then try to figure out what went wrong. This gives you a jump start on that process. Mm-hmm. So anyway.
Very good, Fuzz.
Yeah.
Well, let's segue to the discovery I'm going to talk about. And it's actually an update / review. It was published in Science, and it's called The Planet Inside. Mm. And I was pleased reading it in that it basically affirmed everything I wrote in chapter 14 of my next book, Design to the Core.
That's always a good
thing. That's always encouraging, because I kind of went out on a limb as to say, okay, I think this is what's going on inside the core of our Earth, using all the available research. Well, this came out just a week ago and saying, hey, there's newly published stuff that's not yet published, but it's in the preprint stage. That's basically affirming what I'd written. So I'm kind of giving a sigh of relief. Hey, I really did interpret things correctly. And now we got a much stronger case for what I was stating in chapter 14. The book will be out, by the way, either in June or July, maybe even as early as May, but they said more likely later rather than earlier. As you know, there's a printing issue.
Yeah.
The book's been at the press for 2 months, and it'll be another 2 months probably before it sees the light of day. But basically, this review is dealing with the problem of how is it that Earth has maintained a protective magnetosphere for life. I mean, we've had life on planet Earth for 3.8 billion years, and throughout that period of time, there's been a magnetosphere surrounding the Earth that's protected life at the surface of the Earth from deadly solar radiation and deadly cosmic radiation. Without that magnetosphere, we wouldn't be here, Fuzz. So we need that. But what's been in the literature in the last couple of years is the fact that Earth began with a liquid core, a core made up predominantly of iron with about 5% nickel. So it was a nickel-iron alloy. And then there were a few other elements in there as well. You got maybe less than 5% would be made up of sulfur, oxygen, carbon, hydrogen. There's one, I think it's sodium, that's in there as well. So a smattering of these light elements, but predominantly an iron-nickel alloy where iron completely dominates. But, you know, the Earth began with a very hot origin. You've got two planets, Theia and the proto-Earth, merging together that led to the formation of the moon. But that meant that the Earth started off really hot because there's a lot of heat that was generated by that merger event. And so that liquefied the iron in the core of the Earth. And the moon was close to the Earth at that time because to get a magnetosphere, you need liquid ferrous metals. Mm-hmm. And ferrous metals would be iron, nickel, and cobalt. So you need liquid ferrous metals, but you have to circulate it. Right. If you don't circulate, you don't get a dynamo, you don't get a magnetic field. Well, there were two factors that were circulating the liquid iron in the core of the Earth during its early history. And that was the fact that there was a cooling effect going on at a very hot origin. And so heat was flowing from the interior Earth out through the mantle, the crust, and into interplanetary space. And that heat diffusion basically drove some convection in the liquid iron core. And then the moon was close enough that its tidal friction with the Earth, its tidal forces, also were to circulate. But what's been happening is the moon's been spiraling away at about 4 centimeters per year, which means its tidal forces on the Earth are getting weaker and weaker, which means its capacity to circulate the liquid iron in the interior of the Earth was getting progressively weaker. And then as the core of the Earth cooled down, that also meant that the convection driven by the heat flow was getting weaker. And so what geophysicists have done is they used two approaches to try to determine, because the paleomagnetic data was telling us that the magnetic field of the Earth was starting to weaken from about 1.3 billion years ago. And by 565 million years ago, it was down to 10% of what it is right now. So our magnetic field today is about, depending where you are on the Earth, about 4/10 to 8/10 of a Gauss. And so it dropped to just 1/10 of that, which meant that the Earth was in danger of losing its magnetic field and therefore its magnetosphere, which would have been catastrophic. That would have been the end of life on planet Earth. And, you know, 565 million years ago is when the first animals are appearing.
Right. That's about the, not quite the time of the Cambrian explosion.
Yeah, I'm talking about the Avalon explosion. I think that was started about 575. But that would have meant we would have had a life history on planet Earth of microbes, but no animals.
Yeah.
And so we saw the magnetic field dropping down. And then we noticed it began to drop about 1.3 billion years ago. And by 565 million years ago, it was getting dangerously low to the point where you'd be worried about the magnetosphere being permanently gone. Mm. And so, but then we noticed that the magnetic field quickly strengthened. It was at 10% and then almost immediately went back up to where it is now and has stayed that way. And the presumption was the reason why we had this sudden, you know, the weakening was slow, then we had this sudden jump and the strength of the magnetic field is because a solid inner core formed. And so as the Earth began to cool, the pressure at the interior of the Earth would begin to cause a solid inner core to form, and there'd be a liquid outer core around it. And, you know, the interaction of the heat flow from the solid inner core to the liquid core, that generated some convection, but an even more powerful convection was generated by the squeezing of these light elements, the sulfur, the oxygen, the carbon, the hydrogen. This was being squeezed out of the solid core into the liquid core, and it was that squeezing out and pushing up of these elements, and they would move up all the way into the mantle. That's now responsible for 80% of the convection in the liquid core of the Earth. And so that would have come on as soon as the solid core formed, you would get that diffusion taking place, and that would explain why we see the magnetic field jump so suddenly from 10% up to where it is now and remaining there. Because as the Earth continues to cool, that solid core is getting bigger and bigger. It's getting bigger by a few millimeters per year. So it continues to grow in terms of its diameter, and that continues to have these light elements flow out. and then the heat flow itself generates a convection. So we got the magnetic field. But the remarkable thing is that it happened in the nick of time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if it had been delayed just a little bit more, it would have been too late. The magnetic field would have disappeared, magnetosphere would have disappeared, and the Earth would have been sterilized. There'd be no life here at all, and we wouldn't be here, Fuzz, if it wasn't for that magnetic field kicking in just in the nick of time. But this paper and the chapter I wrote, because basically what I was dealing with when I wrote the chapter was you had conflicting evidence. You had a computer model. You were talking about a computer model, a computer model of the interior of the Earth, knowing the composition of the interior of the Earth, the pressures that must exist there. They were able to build a computer model as to what we should expect to be happening with that magnetic field. And that date came in at about 1.3 to 1 billion years ago, a little bit of an error bar on it because of the fact that the computer modeling wasn't as sophisticated as they wanted. But then you had the paleomagnetic data saying 565 million years ago. And so for about a three-year period in the scientific literature, there was a major debate going on. Who's right and who's wrong? The paleomagnetic people are saying 565 million years ago. The computer modeling people were saying 1.3 billion years ago. And so what I wrote about in chapter 14, there's a way to resolve the discrepancy. Because as I read the papers, I realized the computer modeling was well done. So I said, it can't be wrong. But the paleomagnetic measurements can't be wrong either. There must be a way of resolving the two so that both are right. And at all, and this is what was in this review paper, but it's also what I wrote about in chapter 14, how you resolve the two is you got two forms of iron crystals under very high pressure. You got the cubic crystal form of iron, and you got the hexagonal form of iron. And hexagonal iron has a melting point of 7,000 Kelvin, whereas the cubic form has a melting temperature of 6,000. Okay, with the Earth cooling, that means you're going to get the hexagonal form solidifying first and the cubic form solidifying later. Let me make sure I got that right. Yeah, okay. The cubic form, the cubic form, it's at 7,000, I had it wrong. The cubic form is at 7,000 Kelvin, hexagonal form is at 6,000 Kelvin. But the point is, they have two, even though they're both iron, when they crystallize, you get two different melting temperatures. So it explains why you actually see a signal at 1.3 billion years ago, and you get a later signal at 565 million years ago, because you got two different forms of iron in the high-pressure crystal form with two different melting temperatures separated by 1,000 degrees. Now, another complicating factor, though, is when you got nickel as an alloy with the iron, it lowers the melting temperature by about 400 or 500 degrees. So we're really looking at, say, 6,600 degrees versus 5,600 degrees. But it does explain. And also, you really need it to kick in about 1.3 billion years ago. Otherwise, you're going to see that magnetic field disappearing a lot faster. Bottom line, it's a remarkable fine-tuning thing. So if we got let's actually show people some pictures here. This shows you the interior of the Earth. And so that red-orange factor, that's the solid inner core that exists today. 565 million years ago, that was a lot smaller. 1.3 billion is when the core first began to solidify, and it's been growing ever since. Number five there, where you got that yellow-orange feature, that's the liquid core. So you can see that the liquid core today is much larger than the inner core. And that explains why we have such a strong magnetic field. It's still mostly liquid. A time is going to come when, as the solid core continues to grow, that means the liquid core is going to get smaller and smaller. So a time will come when the magnetic field will weaken, and when it completely solidifies, it'll completely disappear. Mm. Now, that's not going to happen tomorrow. we're looking at another 1 billion years before we run into a problem, really another 3 or 4 billion years before it becomes completely solid, by which time we're going to have other disasters striking our planet. So no need to readjust your investment portfolio, at least not right yet. The green part, 3 and 4, represents the mantle layers, mm-hmm. The upper mantle and the lower mantle. And then that little blue thing, that's the ocean. The brown, that's the crust of the Earth and the asthenosphere. So that's kind of what the interior of the Earth looks like. And the next slide actually shows you what happens when you've got a solid inner core and a liquid outer core. And you can see how much bigger the liquid outer core is than the inner core. This generates convection currents. And so those little yellow circulation lines show you the convection currents. And it's those convection currents that set up a dynamo that generates a magnetic field and the magnetosphere. And again, the moon actually contributes a tiny amount to that convection, but it's really almost trivial. It's less than 1%. That was significant when the moon was a lot closer. So the moon really isn't a big factor today. The two main sources are the heat flow from the interior of the Earth out through to the crust of the Earth, interplanetary space. That's about 20% of the convection. Mm-hmm. The other 80% is a squeezing out of the light elements that are in the inner core and having them been squeezed into the liquid core, then out into the mantle. That's 80% of the convection energy. But yeah, it's game over when the whole core becomes solid, which is what's happened to the moon. Mm. The moon had a magnetic field because it also had a liquid iron core and was close enough to the Earth in its early history that the tidal forces of the Earth powerfully generated convection currents in the moon. So for the first 450 million years of the moon's existence, it had as strong a magnetic field as the Earth has today. But once the core solidified, that happened about 3.9 billion years ago. That's when the magnetic field of the moon disappeared.
Did Mars ever have a magnetosphere?
It probably did, but for a very short period of time. If you go previous to about 4 billion years ago, it would have had, probably it had a magnetosphere, probably it had some plate tectonics, but it shut down very quickly. And that's something I also write about in Design to the Core, is that the amount of plate tectonics and the dynamo is a function of the mass of the planet. And so Mars being only 1/9 the mass of the Earth, it's going to have a very short-lived season of plate tectonics and a magnetosphere. And you reach a maximum at exactly the mass of the Earth. When you get more massive than the Earth, it turns around. And so planets more massive than the Earth will have a shorter period of plate tectonics. There'll be weaker plate tectonics and a weaker magnetic field until you get to a gas giant. Jupiter is a strong magnetic field, but it's because the hydrogen in its interior gets magnetized. Mm-hmm. So hydrogen actually is another ferrous metal, but it needs to be in solid form. So you need a really big planet with an enormous amount of gravity to generate that. Mm. But rocky planets, the principle is the plate tectonic duration and strength goes up to a peak at exactly the mass of the Earth, and after that it declines. Mm. Which means if you want to have a long history of life on a planet, it's got to be a planet of the mass of the Earth, and not just the mass of the Earth, it also had to the density of the Earth. Mm-hmm. Because Earth is the densest planet in the solar system, and it's a combination of its mass and its density that explains why it has such a long-lasting magnetosphere and long-lasting plate tectonics. And also, there's another heat source. And we only talked here about the heat that comes from the merger event that led to the proto-Earth and from the accumulation earlier of planetesimals that led to the formation of the proto-Earth. But there's another significant source of heat in the interior of the Earth, and that's the enormous abundance of uranium and thorium. Mm-hmm. Our planet Earth has way more uranium and thorium than any other known rocky body by a factor of more than 100. So that's another significant source of heat.
Now, the movement of the outer core is also setting up the convection currents in the mantle, right, which are primarily responsible for the tectonic activity.
That's correct, because you've got heat flowing out from the solid core into the liquid core, into the mantle, out into the asthenosphere, the crust, and into interplanetary space. But yeah, what's happening in the mantle is crucial for generating the plate tectonics. And what I loved is the part I wrote about the asthenosphere. It's a very thin layer mm-hmm. between the mantle and the crust, and that's probably the most fine-tuned item of the interior of the Earth. Without the asthenosphere being exactly the way it is, there would be no life on the surface of the Earth, and it's unlikely we're ever going to find another body that's got an asthenosphere like the Earth. Mm. I mean, I'm looking forward to actually recruiting a team of geophysicists that can take the three chapters I wrote on the interior of the Earth and making it an entire book. Mm. At least I got the project going.
Yeah. So when the magnetosphere of the Earth at about, 575 million years ago practically disappeared. Would that have also impacted tectonic activity at that time? Because it seems like if that's the case, then it's like a double whammy, because not only is it, again, you're losing the magnetosphere, but you're losing the carbonate-silicate cycle, right?
Yes, that was also slowing down. And, we geophysicists refer to what they call the great unconformity, because what happened just before the first Avalon explosion of life, there was a major geological upheaval, which caused huge amounts of continental landmass material to slide off the continents and basically form the continental shelves in the oceans, which was the seed for all these Avalon animals and mm-hmm. Cambrian animals. And it's like, okay, what could have been responsible for that great unconformity? Well, if you got the solid core forming, so that's research is going on right now. They're actually thinking, because it happens at the same time. Mm. So they're basically saying the beginning of the growth of the solid inner core probably had a major dynamical effect on the mantle of the Earth, which would have had a huge effect on the tectonics. So think of like magnitude 12 earthquakes all over the world. This would explain those enormous land masses. Mm. And so just like the magnetic field was kicked up, likewise, the plate tectonic activity was kicked up, and that might explain. But I mean, without that great unconformity, we wouldn't have had the oxygen in Earth's atmosphere that we have today, because there was a huge spike of oxygen that happened just before the Avalon explosion. And then you got the formation of those continental shelves, which provided a habitat for all these marine animals. So yeah, it's an amazing story.
Yeah. I mean, it's remarkable to think that all these things are lining up in the just right way to make, you know, advanced animal life possible on the planet. And that's
They hint about that in this review paper that, hey, this happened in the nick of time, the timing was remarkable, and this is what we made possible, the animals. But yeah, that was barely two sentences in their review, and it's like they're really not getting just how incredible this is and why you need divine miraculous intervention to really explain all this.
Yeah, well, because it still doesn't, in a sense, while it may have, these confluence of events may have created this just right environment for advanced life, it still doesn't explain how that advanced life could somehow acquire the genetic changes needed to go from unicellular organisms or colonial aggregates.
Yeah, you go from microbes and colonies of microbes to instantly you've got big animals.
Yeah.
How do you go from microbes to big animals in a whisper of time? And also, I mean, something I write about is that just before the Avalon explosion, you got three major slush ball events. Mm. What I mean by that is where 80% plus of the planet becomes covered with thick ice. And that's crucial to get the oxygen up to where it needs to be for animal life. It's also crucial to bring down the carbon dioxide level so that you don't get the surface of the planet being overheated. And so everything is happening at just the right time. You get these three major glaciation events. Now, that could have wiped out all life on planet Earth if it became an ice ball event. But there were slush balls, not ice balls. Mm-hmm. So life survived through it all that. But that was crucial to pave the way for animal life.
Yeah.
And so to me, the simultaneity and the timing of all these disparate events tells me this is the signal of the handiwork of God.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, it's the ideas you're bringing up are very similar to the ideas that Lawrence Henderson wrote about in Fitness of the Environment, where he was commenting on really the chemical environment of the Earth, not the geological setting where you have water, carbon dioxide, we now know oxygen, though Henderson didn't include oxygen in his analysis, and then just the nature of carbon chemistry, all having these just right properties that create a setting in which life is even possible. And so you couldn't have life emerging, let alone existing, if it wasn't for this confluence of factors that made the chemical environment just right. You know, but even when the environment is just right, it still doesn't explain how life could have originated through evolutionary means.
Right.
You know, and it seems like there's a parallel with the Cambrian explosion, that there's a confluence of these incredible geological factors that create a just right environment.
Yeah, but the moment that the conditions are possible to make the existence of these animals, you immediately see the animals.
Yeah.
There's no evolutionary time delay. Naturalistic evolution would say there's going to be a period of significant time to go from microbes to animals. But the moment the oxygen is there to permit the existence of these animals, they're immediately there. And not just in one form. We see multiple phyla all showing up simultaneously.
Well, you know, and to go from, again, like colonial aggregates of single cells to organisms that have these, you know, integrated, sophisticated, integrated biological systems, you just aren't just adding genes to the mix. You've got to have this very elaborate network of gene regulation that is a function of time, because you have to have not only a developmental process, but also that developmental process has to happen in the just right way to create these biological systems that are highly integrated.
Right.
So, you know, you've got to, you know, similar to the challenge in how do you go from simple molecules to the very first cell, you got that same problem, you know, in terms of, you know, natural processes having the mechanisms to actually.
Something you might say to viewers, I've heard you say this, Fuzz, is that people can think we're critiquing Darwinism. We're really critiquing naturalism. And I know naturalists don't like to be referred to as Darwinists. Sometimes they refer to themselves as neo-Darwinists. On the other hand, when you read their papers, they are talking about natural selection just like Charles Darwin, but that was the only mechanism Darwin could propose.
Right.
We now know there's mutations. We now know there's gene exchange.
Yeah.
We now know there's epigenetics operating. Well, all four of those mechanisms work slowly to produce small changes,
right,
which means you need time to get anything significant happening. And the fossil record tells us there's no time, no measurable time.
And I'm not even convinced that those mechanisms can actually generate biological novelty.
Right.
Or can propel life from one regime of complexity to the other.
Right.
That I'm not convinced that those mechanisms can do that.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks, Buzz.
Yeah.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Stars, Cells, and God. And again, we post these on both our Facebook channel and our YouTube channel. But if you go to the Reasons to Believe YouTube channel, you can subscribe for free, and that will be your portal to be alerted to all the different videos that we post there. So do take advantage of that. The subscription's free. And RTB_official is your portal to all the social media windows that we have at Reasons to Believe. Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. Every one of the scholars at Reasons to Believe has a Facebook and a Twitter page, and that's where we answer your questions. I mean, if you're like me and you watch an episode like this, you think of a great question 4 hours after it's all over. Well, you're welcome to come to our different Facebook and Twitter pages and post your questions. We're not guaranteeing to answer every question that's posted there. I mean, sometimes I'll put up a post and there'll be 100 questions. I do my best to get to as many of them as I can. I know you face the same challenge, Fuzz, but do take advantage of that. And also, reasons.org, that'll take you to our website, And there's literally thousands of articles that Fuzz and I and the rest of the scholars, and now our scholar community mm-hmm. is publishing there. So use that not only for your own enjoyment, but look for opportunities to share those things that we provide, whether they be videos or articles, with your non-Christian friends. Our mission is to see people come to faith through Christ, through taking the discoveries in the book of nature to bring people to the book of Scripture into relationship with Jesus Christ. So please partner with us in that mission. And hey, if you're not yet a follower of Jesus Christ, we're here to provide the evidence and answer the questions that you have. So we're available, and take advantage of that. Thank you.